is the postmodern condition something that we should celebrate and deliberately try to bring about in our artistic works and in our written works and in our thinking and theorizing as a liberation from the grand old meta-narratives? Or is the postmodern condition simply something that we are stuck in, whether we like it or not, a circumstance of our time and our place? Well, yesterday, when I looked at Jean-François Lyotard, he argued the former position. Today, I'm looking at Frederick Jameson, who very much argued the latter position from the basic theoretical framework of Western Marxism. He argues that postmodernism is not some artistic movement, some liberation from modernism, some emancipatory aesthetic, as Lyotard tried to argue, but rather it is the cultural logic of late capitalism itself. For Jameson, postmodernism is the cultural expression of a new stage of capitalism, one that is multinational, one that is globalized, one that is driven by finance and information. Culture and economy have become tightly interwoven, and so tightly interwoven that cultural forms directly express the underlying logic of the economic system itself. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about what Jameson means in a moment, but I want you to bear in mind, if you haven't watched yesterday's lecture on Lyotard, you should stop this and go and watch that one, and then come back and watch this one. I want you to think a little bit about what he's saying. Postmodernism, therefore, is not something that you want to celebrate. It's not something that we're particularly happy about. It is simply a symptom of the fact that we're in this multinational, globalized, financialized, late stage of capitalism. He says that under these postmodern conditions, culture exhibits a pronounced loss of depth. The older senses of underlying meaning, of historical weight, of authentic emotion, progressively weaken. What remains is a flat play of surfaces, of mere style, and this and intensities that rarely connect to deep, fuller meaning or significance. Emotion is replaced by free-floating euphoria or anxiety detached from any clear cause. Now, what is he really talking about here? Okay, let us compare for a second, a romantic or a transcendental piece of classical music. Right, think of Beethoven or Mozart or Beethoven, something like this. I think Beethoven said when he writes a piece of music, he wants basically for people to experience something of the transcendent, of the divine, of the sheer majesty of the glorious nature of things. It should be awe-inspiring. As against a pop song, such as How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? Or a song, let us say, Summer Holiday by Cliff Richard. Or, I don't know, a Beatles song. She loves me, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves me, yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, just so happens, I like the Beatles. And if you're watching this, you probably like the Beatles too. But you can see that there's a difference, really, between the Beethoven and the Beatles. And it wasn't for nothing that in the 60s they said, roll over, Beethoven. There's a new show in town. But this new show in town is the appearance of style. It is something that is building on something that has come before. We'll get back to that in a second. But it is unable to get much, it's unable to kind of really reach those depths of human experience that you might get in something like a Beethoven or a Mozart. Okay. Now we can start to quibble with this in a second, and you know, just bear me out a second. He says that we get pastiche in place of parody. In modernism, in the high modernist moment, let's say in the poetry of T.S. Eliot or Ezra Pound, okay, these were modernists, we get parody. That is, there is a critical distance that remains possible in modernism. Earlier styles can be mocked, they can be subverted, or they can be used in an ironic way. Imitation carries satirical intent and normative force. But in postmodernism, this degenerates to mere pastiche. Styles are recycled as pure aesthetic material, neutral, without satirical purpose. Imitation is blank. No norm exists against which to measure deviation. Now, the idea of the pastiche, I need to put this into concrete terms. All right, we started with the Beatles, okay? Now, there's a really interesting question to ask. Were the Beatles a modernist act or a postmodern act? Loves me, yeah. Right, now, if you want to be really kind of pedantic about it all, you could say, well, the Beatles, they were really doing a pastiche of skiffle acts that they'd seen when they were growing up. They were a Liverpudlian band doing a kind of pastiche of American style rock and roll. She loves me, yeah. Okay, they were basically already a pastiche. The Beatles were, okay. Now, that's the Beatles, who in many ways are the best band that has been produced by, you know, the post-war order, or is held up as the best band. You'll have your own opinions. But now let's fast forward to Simon Cowell on the X Factor. I'll do my best, Simon. I'm already wearing the black T-shirt, look. Okay, I can do my best Simon Cowell impression. Oh, gosh, you know, he's there judging all the different acts, okay? And an act comes on, and he stands up there, and he does his cover of a Beatles song, let's say, on the X Factor. Now, we're getting a pastiche of a pastiche. We'll get it. There's such a gap now between whatever that original thing was, skiffle act in the 1940s or, you know, 1950s garage rock acts in, you know, California or something. Okay, we're quite far away from what the original reference point is that the Beatles were doing when they sang She Loves Me, yeah. And now we are at the level of some douchebag on X Factor singing their version of it. Now, where it gets particularly interesting with something like X Factor is that X Factor is now, I don't even know if it's still on, but it ran for a very long time. You know, shows like Pop, you know, that kind of reality kind of Pop Idol X Factor thing that ran for a very long time. What's the other one called? Britain's Got Talent, and there's a few others. Now, those shows have been running, they ran for many, many years, almost like 20 years of those shows. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember when people like, what was his name? Gareth Gates. And there was that one, Will Young. Do you remember that? They were some of the very early winners. And I'm also old enough to remember Take That in the charts in the 90s. Now, Take That, there's quite a big distance between the Beatles and Take That. You could argue there's already been another level of degeneration between the Beatles and an act like Take That. Okay. But then you get, let's pretend, Gareth Gates or Will Young going on X Factor and singing the Take That song. And then they become famous in their own right. And you get the X Factor contestant doing a cover version of Gareth Gates or Will Young. Okay, so now let's pretend the original reference point is whatever it is the Beatles were, you know, channeling there in the 1960s. And then we've gone, like, we've come all the way now where we're getting a pastiche of something like Take That. So not even the original, not even the original Gary Barlow. He is now like a kind of godlike figure, seen as being the real deal, seen as being authentic, which is laughable if you grew up in the 90s. Take That were kind of an earth, like, you know, a manufactured boy band. But now Take That actually have got like credibility in the current kind of, 26 years later, 30 years later, they've got cred in these sorts of scenes. So we've gone from Take That, whatever they are, from the Beatles, to whatever Gareth Gates and Will Young were to Take That, to whatever now the current contestants are to the Gareth Gates or the Will Young, who were already a pastiche of a pastiche of a pastiche. What's the original referent here? What's the original authentic? I mean, it's probably some old black dude in the 1930s, you know, playing an acoustic guitar, Blind Willie McTell or something, right? If you really want to go, you know, it's probably something like that. All those 60s acts were looking back to, you know, looking back to that sort of era. But now, like, see how far away we are from the original reference point in something like the modern day X Factor contestant who's singing the Will, literally not even a Beatles cover, a cover of Gareth Gates or Will Young. This is what Frederick Jameson is truly talking about with the idea of the pastiche. And now think of the absurdity of the difference of awareness and the difference of sophistication and wherewithal, even, okay, between Ezra Pound writing his cantos, right, or T.S. Eliot deliberately, you know, evoking John Donne or Shakespeare or Andrew Marvell or Beowulf or whatever he was doing in his poetry. And he probably did all of those things at one time or another. Deliberately playing games with, you know, the form as he was doing, Eliot and Pound. Versus the teenager who's up there in front of Simon Cowell singing the Gareth Gates song as Simon Cowell does that and says, I don't know if this one's going to make it. Now, what's happening in that moment of Simon Cowell doing that? It's not just what he's not doing is thinking, oh my gosh, how have we got here? How have we got to a teenager singing a Gareth Gates song, right, in the final of X Factor? He's not thinking that. He's thinking, is this going to make money? Can I sell this as product? Is this person good enough to fit into my prepackaged hole as product? And let's come back to Frederick Jameson to think about what we're talking about here. Do you remember he said, in the cultural logic of late capitalism, the cultural form directly expresses the underlying logic of the economic system. In other words, the record producer Simon Cowell rubbing his forehead thinking, is this going to make me money? And telling the audience that is what is happening here. And the audience saying, we know that's happening. And to quote Althusser yet again, they say, so be it, amen. Simon Cowell, we will, as willing pigs, eat your slop. You will serve it up and we will cheer it along and we will buy it. Whether it's Gareth Gates or Will Young or Marty McCutcheon, or any number of any ever here today, gone tomorrow, you know, X Factor contestants. It was that one, Alexandra something. You know, there's so many of them. Susan Boyle. They even bought Susan. The public are such willing pigs that they even bought Susan Boyle records. Thousands of people will watch this lecture, and I can guarantee you there will be somebody watching this who's got to take that record. Somebody watching this who's got a Gareth Gates record, a Will Young record, and a Susan Boyle record. If you're the one with a Susan Boyle record, you need to reveal yourself. I'm not going to... Here's the thing about Frederick Jameson. He's not really saying it's your fault. He's saying this is what it is. This is where we are. This is what late capitalism is. Of course you're a consuming slop pig. Of course you are. What else are you going to be? This is the world that you've been born into. This is what every strand of ideology has been saying to you since the minute that you were born. What chance did you have? You weren't exposed to proper art. And even if you were, you wouldn't know how to process it because you're postmodern. So listen, roll over Beethoven and actually roll over Beatles, because what you want is Susan Boyle singing a Barry Manilow song or something. We get in this moment the collapse of high and low culture, such that the consumer of the slop pig actively resents that even the notion of there being a high culture and a low culture. That's snobby, you'll say. We don't like that anymore. We're not like that anymore. That's snobby. Actually, there is no real difference between Susan Boyle and Beethoven. And in fact, things are probably at the point where there's somebody somewhere, probably about my age, saying, oh, do you know what? They don't make them like they used to. Do you remember that Susan Boyle? They're not as good as that anymore, are they? Which is exactly what happened, by the way, with Take That. Take That in the 90s, you know. I mean, but now they've got kind of like they've built up credibility. This also happened with ABBA, by the way. And many, many, many other acts who... Anyway, let's not get into all of that. Music is just one area where you can see this play out. Jameson's not just talking about music. He's talking about every form of art there is, and literature as well. He was actually a literary critic, so that's probably what he had in mind a lot of the time. And films, of course, and television. The earlier division between elite, modernist, high art and mass popular low culture has largely dissolved. Both now operate within a single market-driven system of cultural production. Art, entertainment, advertising, and design circulate on the same plane, differentiated only by the price point rather than by aesthetic or critical principle. To the point where to suggest that one is better than the other is actively offensive to most people. In the postmodern condition, in the cultural logic of late capitalism, we get a loss of historicity. Many postmodern subjects find it increasingly difficult to experience history as a meaningful, unfolding process. The past appears primarily as a repertoire of stylish images and nostalgic references rather than as a lived continuity. The sense of inhibiting an ongoing historical narrative connecting the past, the present, and the future becomes ever more difficult to sustain under late capitalism's perpetual present. We are disconnected from the past because we live in a perpetual moment. We experience it all as a fragmented archive rather than in times of yore, which experience time in sense in terms of a sense of continuity. Now, I've often said that this is reflected in the way that history is taught in most schools, where it's modular and there's no kind of overarching. You know, I remember teaching a lot of students that were not able to say with any great certainty, you know, they didn't have a sense of it was the medieval era, then it was the Renaissance, then it was the Reformation, then it was the Restoration. They didn't really have that map. Then the Victorians came. They just kind of studied history piecemeal. They experienced it all higgledy-piggledy. They didn't know how one bit of it connected to another bit of it. But it's not just this. It's more. Because if you think about it, people say, you know, I've been talking about X Factor. People say, it's weird, because between now and the year 2000, when all this stuff came in, like X Factor and Simon Cowell and all of that, Strictly Come Dancing and all the rest of it, feels like nothing's happened. You know, like the distance between, let's say, 1940 and 1960, we're talking about the Beatles, right? The gap between Frank Sinatra and the Beatles was only like 10 years, but it feels like a different epoch. Right, the gap between, I don't know, some of those old lounge club singers and Jimi Hendrix feels like night and day. Whereas if you have a look at the X Factor, it just hasn't changed. As far as I know, Big Brother is still on TV. As far as all those shows that came in around the year 2000, it's like we've been, it's just like they never change. This is the perpetual present. There is no history to this. When did it start? When did it finish? I don't know. I'm reminded a little bit of that David Mitchell sketch on the football. Do you remember? And now it's the football. There will be matches and goals will be scored. And after that, more football to see who will win the league and who will win the league again and who will win the cup and the football. Because again, and it's a strange thing. Since, I guess you'd say, the Premiership era, a lot of footballers just seem to play out in this perpetual present. It's a hard thing to explain, but it's disconnected, right? It's disconnected. You know, I was saying about the football and the Premiership, you'd be surprised how many fans you meet who don't really want to acknowledge that there was a football before about 1992. No, football history start with the Premiership. And even worse, there can be some, even worse than that, talk about the pastiche of the pastiche, there can be some now who don't want to act as if football existed before, you know, Manchester City and the mega billions and Guardiola revolution and all of that sort of stuff. The perpetual, like truly, you know, a lack of continuity between what has been and what was before. So yeah, it's a kind of an interesting thing to watch play out, because it kind of hovers, this perpetual present hovers free. It kind of exists in its own vacuum, where, okay, you can have a look at a clip of X Factor and you can kind of try to count the amount of gray hair in Simon Cowell's hair, right, to try to guess when it was. But apart from that, you probably wouldn't know, because it just never changes. And I mean, it's not just that, it's every area of life that you can think of. I you know, in the world of pro wrestling, which I've mentioned so many times, you know, it's like it's just in a time warp. You watch it and you know it's still people are coming out with kind of attitude era style music and looks, and it just hasn't changed. Like so many things haven't changed in the past 25, 30 years. They just exist in this, almost like this vacuum, this nothingness. I have a really interesting book here written by a guy here on YouTube. In fact, I'll see if I can find it, which is kind of in this mode. I thought I'd mention it. It's called Where is it? I can't find it now. It's the guy who did the Oswald Spengler lectures, if you remember him, John something. And he wrote a book on the idea was everything has a cultural half-life. Okay, cultural half-life. I'll be kicking myself. I can't remember the name of that guy, and I can't quite see his book right now. If somebody mentions it in the comments, he did like the definitive series on Spengler's Decline of the West, you know, on YouTube years ago. John Abert, I think his name was, or is. And he wrote this book called Cultural Half-Life, or the big idea in it. And he goes through modern music. He goes through film. He goes through like different areas of life where he's like, look, even this thing, right, like the Beatles, say, or the explosion of energy that happened in the 60s. Now, Frederick Jameson is calling that already postmodern, by the way. But he's saying that even that had its own half-life, which then degenerated, went into self-pastiche, and then ended up in this kind of stasis that we've been experiencing in the culture at large for about the past 30 years. Very interesting idea, and it's a very Frederick Jameson-y sort of idea. I don't know if Abert has read Jameson, but it's in the same sort of ballpark. Jameson says that there's also been a spatial disorientation, that, you know, there is a traditional way of experiencing space, but late capitalist space is already kind of commodified and commercialized and turned into something else. Late capitalism generates spaces, architecture, digital spaces, financial centers and things like that, that systematically exceed the individual's capacity to locate themselves within the larger global system. Jameson's famous example is the Bone Adventure Hotel in Los Angeles. Okay, so he's looking at these kind of this modern hotel. I think that, and as the internet has become more and more of a thing as well, this has become ever increasingly true of everything. How many times have you been in a shop recently where you want to buy something and the guy looks and he says, oh, you can order it online? What's that item? Oh, that's just for show. We don't actually have it here. You can order it online, though. Well, what's this shop then? I'm in a shop. It's the pastiche of a shop. It's not actually a shop. It's a pastiche of a shop. It's a front for an online store. One example or another. I mean, you know, you think of spaces in London like the Shard, or, you know, any of those kind of glass and steel type buildings where they're kind of nowhere. Yeah, you're in London, but you could also be anywhere. I always remember going, I mentioned him earlier on this week, Stephen Carson, my buddy Radical Liberation. Well, we went to a Mises conference in New York back in 2018. And we had a day to kind of hang out in New York before the conference. And we were like, let's go down. We were staying in the financial district because that's where the conference was. And we were like, well, what can we do? Let's go and have a look at the World Trade Center, like the site of where the 9/11 attacks happened. You know, and that's been a theme this week as well, because I started the week with Guy Debord, you know, did 9/11, like outside of the media, did it really happen, etc. Anyway, so we went down to visit the site of 9/11. And there they've built this thing called the World One Center. The World One Center is this massive shopping mall, basically, and it's got this wide open white space. I don't know if it's still there, but in 2018, this is what was at the World Trade Center, this World One Center, it was called. And I remember walking through there, and they had, like, you know, store here, a store there. There was one of those, cheesecake factory places. And we were walking through, and I'll never forget that Stephen turned to me and he said, you know what, AA? I hate this place. absolutely hate. Like, everything, this is so soulless, it's so horrible, it's eerie, it's weird, we could be anywhere. I hate what they've done with this space. And it was difficult not to agree with him, because where were we? We were kind of nowhere. We were in a kind of globalized community, like we were in the late capitalist disorientating space. And that to me is the really typifies what Jameson is trying to get at here. He's talking about this hotel in Los Angeles. Another example of all of this, and we've already touched on this week as well, is Las Vegas, of course. Everything in Las Vegas is a pastiche of something else. Nothing in Las Vegas is real. You could be in a, you know, you're in Paris, but you're not really in Paris. You're in New York, but it's just a kind of fake facade of New York. Las Vegas is a very weird place. Las Vegas is pure postmodern late capitalism. You know, I would argue actually that Las Vegas is more fun than that place like the One Center in New York, because at least you can recognize what it's trying to, you know, what it's trying to do. Whereas that place that me and Stephen were in is just, I mean, if you're in New York, you'll know what I'm talking, you know, if you've been to New York recently, you'll know what I'm talking about. All of this produces what Jameson calls the fragmented subject. The here and individual, possessed of a continuous life narrative and a stable interiority, gives way to a more fragmented subject. Experience becomes a succession of discontinuous intensities rather than an organized personal story. This shift mirrors, at the level of subjectivity, the broader cultural logic of depthlessness and surface. What's Jameson talking about? People who are living their lives going from moment to moment to moment, having these little dopamine hits here and there, posing for a picture here and there, but these are fundamentally discontinuous. They don't lead to any greater story. They don't lead to meaning or purpose. I go to Paris and I take a selfie in front of the Eiffel Tower. I go to New York and I take a selfie in front of the Statue of Liberty. And I do a manga pose. And this film comes out and I get my popcorn and I go, yay! This thing came out and I love it. This game came out and I love it. This, and you know that you can see it on here on YouTube, people live their whole lives, fully grown men my age, who basically are surrounded with toys, who are surrounded with the products of late capitalism, who spend all their time going from these dopamine hit experiences. The new Star Wars film is out, yay! The new football season starts. Yay! Whatever it is. This is a depthless way to live, says Jameson. And yet this is the experience for most people under late capitalism. This is the fragmented subject. And again, he doesn't blame these people. He makes no moral judgment on them. He's in many ways, he's saying, what can they do about it? This is what mass consumerist capitalism is and what it does to people. Another really interesting idea in Jameson, and you know, he wrote quite a bit, and I only got 10 points in these lectures, let's not forget. But he wrote about the nostalgic mode. He wrote about nostalgia. He wrote about how media and films reconstruct past decades as a stylized aesthetic and as surfaces rather than historically grounded worlds. Now, this has always interested me. Ever since I read Jameson, I've been interested in this idea that the 1960s doesn't really exist. We think of the 1960s as Flower Power and the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and Glastonbury and the Summer of Love and psychedelia, free love. Well, Peter Hitchens, I remember, made a documentary called I Hate the 60s. He was a talking head in it, where he said, the 60s only happened in about 1 square mile of London. Didn't really happen for most people. What was the real 60s for most people? And I've always thought maybe for most people in Britain, the 60s was closer to Carry On films and Cilla Black and stuff like that than it was to all of the way that we remember. The cultural memory of the 60s is distinct from what the 60s actually was. And then, in fact, there's a Carry On film. You know, Once Upon a Time Here on YouTube, I made my own documentary on the Carry On film because they've always fascinated me as a cultural artifact. And in one of the Carry On films, I think it's is it Carry On Camping, or you know, it's one of the ones where they're in at a campsite. Sid James and all the rest of the Carry On crew, they kind of collide with this field of hippies, right? So obviously Sid James is a bloke in his 50s or his 60s, and all of these guys are the older generation. These are people who fought in the war and things like that. Many of them were old military men. They were just an older generation. And they, in this film, collide head on with a bunch of hippies who are having a rave in a kind of muddy field. They wouldn't have had raves. They were having some, you know, free love type hippie party in a field. And the Carry On crew kind of gate crash it. And then it's like, how is this clash of generations going to collide? And it's like, well, inevitably, you know, Sid James kind of gets into the groove of it and has a little bop with the girl who's like, you know, a third of his age, pervs on her. Obviously, Sid James, what else is he going to do? But it's a really interesting little moment of the clash of, in a way, the Britain that most people would have experienced and the way we remember the 60s all happening there in a film made in the 1960s. Another document that always has interested me, I was a big Bob Dylan fan when I was younger. There's a Bob Dylan film, a documentary by D.A. Pennebaker, famous one called Don't Look Back. And basically in that, Bob Dylan goes to London in 1965. Now, our cultural memory of the 60s is literally Bob Dylan. Right, it's the Beatles, it's Bob Dylan, it's Jimmy. It's all, this is how my generation was kind of inculcated into the cultural memory of the 1960s. But that film, Don't Look Back, shows London as it actually was in 1965, and it's much closer to what we think of as a Monty Python sketch, men in bowler hats, you know, people with impossibly posh accents. You know, really nerdy journalists with those big old glasses, really uptight kind of women in outfits that look like they'd be a librarian's outfit. And there's Bob Dylan as Bob Dylan in 1965, clashing with this old-fashioned world that was living and breathing in 1965. And this is what interests me about the Frederick Jameson nostalgia idea, that nostalgia is constructed, that nostalgia is basically made up. And I've watched it happen in my own lifetime. I talked about Take That earlier in this video. I lived through the 90s. I remember it. And I have watched the cultural construction of the memory of the 90s in my own lifetime. I remember Take That. They were shit. Most people weren't that into them. And yet, the cultural construction of the 90s, I've watched play out. I've watched young people kind of look back on that era with envy and fondness in exactly the same way that my generation looked back on the 60s with envy and fondness. Because we had all the boomer magazines pushing it over and over again. That time was better than this time. It's a really fascinating thing. I've watched the cultural memory of the 80s also, that this happened when I was a kid in the 80s, right? But there's quite a big difference between the vaporware Outrun 80s aesthetic that has been consciously made, and you know, Zoomers love it and all that sort of stuff, Stranger Things and all this sort of thing, and the 80s as people actually experienced it. Fascinating thing to watch happen. And the media really perpetuates these reconstructions, these mythical versions of the past. Fashion and design have cyclical revivals of past styles which circulate as a commodity. And this is exactly what I've been talking about. The 90s now coming back and sold as a commodity to the next generation, just as the 60s was packaged and sold to our generation. And the 80s also packaged and sold to, you know, the generation in between. Absolutely fascinating that late capitalism is able to do this, especially when you consider that the 60s and the 70s and the 80s did not exist. They were a construction in the first place, which is Jameson's point. Nostalgia and the mode of nostalgia pervades popular culture, substituting the look of historical periods for genuine historical consciousness. And, you know, it's very interesting to see how this happened. You know, I got a six-year-old daughter. She watched those Minions films. You know, Minions, Gru, and those Despicable Me or whatever. But anyway, those films, one of them is in the 60s, and they go and meet the Queen. I think the whole plot is around stealing the crown jewels in 60s in London, okay? And then the second one is in the 70s, and there's like a disco queen and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, well, every single part of the 60s in Minions and the 70s in Minions is completely made up. It's completely, I mean, I don't know if they carry on. I think that maybe the next one is in the 80s or whatever. It's amazing. You know, we were talking a couple of lectures back, Baudrillard. You know, the sign refers to nothing outside of itself. It's a symbolic order that is entirely self-referential. What we're talking about here is something that only exists as a media phenomenon, referring back only to the media phenomenon, and then people getting genuine nostalgia for the media phenomenon in itself. Jameson's most programmatic proposal is a new form of cultural and political representation that he called cognitive mapping. Drawing on Kevin Lynch's urban theory, Jameson argues that subjects must find ways to locate themselves within the complex, unrepresentable totality of late capitalism, recovering a sense of orientation that current cultural forms systematically deny. Now, where I find this very interesting is that probably the people who have most tried to do this, most tried to carve out authentic little niches, or, you know, the ability to get back to that diachronic sense of continuity with the past, are probably people quite far outside the mainstream and in areas like pagan revivalism, for example, or, you know, someone like Survive the Jive, who has really gone quite far outside these sorts of things and has kind of developed a cognitive map for himself and also for his sense of connection to his own people. I recently wrote an article on self-initiation in a, you know, kind of spiritual area. I have this side channel, Academic Agent Mindset. And in a way, what I'm doing on that channel, and in a way, what self-initiation is, and in a way, what Julius Evola talks about, is making Frederick Jameson's cognitive map. Now, probably Frederick Jameson, being a left winger, being a Marxist, and so on and so forth, wouldn't like those modes. He'd say, oh, no, that's reactionary or something. Maybe. I don't know. Jameson's a pretty deep thinker, so I'd like to think that he'd take what I just said seriously, that he would actually, you know, see it as an attempt to find an orientation. One of Evola's most famous essays is called Orientations. Why? Because the man of tradition is so disorientated, is so far outside of where he should be in the current order, in the late capitalist mode, that you need a map. And what I find fascinating is when people as different as Jameson and some of the people I've just talked about are reaching for the same thing. They're pointing to the same problem in two different ways. And these are the things that I find intellectually exciting. And they're also the areas where I see some hope. Because if Jameson can see it and a man like Evola can see it, then maybe other great minds can see it as well. And maybe there'll be some clamor to find something else. Postmodern culture has an ideological character. Postmodern culture presents itself as a pluralistic, playful, and liberated place, yet it remains deeply ideological. This is Jameson clapping back, to use the language of the youth, clapping back at Lyotard's rather optimistic, rather cheerful depiction of the postmodern condition, which I talked about yesterday. This is Jameson saying, no, Lyotard, this may look like pluralism, this may look like liberation, it's not. Don't be fooled. All of it expresses the logic of late capitalism. Cultural forms naturalize the social relations of multicultural capitalism, rendering them invisible precisely by making them ubiquitous. Which Spice Girl are you? Are you a scary Spice? Are you a sporty Spice or what? Because Lyotard's world of disparate language games doesn't actually do anything to fight that. That's what Jameson is kind of saying here. This pluralistic, playful, liberated mode of unlimited individual self-expression, where everybody has 57 gender identities, disables systematic critique. It weakens the categories of history, totality and depth. Postmodern culture undermines the very tools that earlier critical theory depended upon to analyze and contest the system. In fact, it dissolves them like a corrosive acid and sells it back to them as a commodity. And that is Frederick Jameson in a nutshell. Now, forgive me, folks, I got a little bit animated today. I record these all in a row, and today is a hot day, and I got a little bit excited here. Maybe some people will like my energy, but I try to stay calm. But I find myself getting passionate at times. I really care about some of this material. I really care about it. And I've thought about it long and hard for going on 20 odd years at this point. So hopefully you got something from the work of Frederick Jameson and it made you think. And maybe you've got your own ideas about how you can get out, how you can actually free yourself and live a more authentic, connected life, even within the confines of late capitalism. Where can you carve out that authentic escape from the postmodern condition? Because in Jameson, the postmodern condition is something to escape from, not something to champion and embrace and play with, like in Lyotard. And certainly, this is something I've struggled with my entire life, my entire adult life. I've been looking for something authentic and real. I've been down every route. So, have a good weekend, ladies and gentlemen. Pick up a course, speaking of capitalism, pick up a course at the academic agency, buy it now, and I'll catch you all next week.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.